big rock and waited for an hour, listening for any sound which might give us a clue to Elsa's whereabouts. I strained my ears, but all was still. Finally, I could bear the suspense no longer and called. There was no answer. Was Elsa dead? Hoping that the lion's spoor might lead us to her, we took up his tracks, where we had left them, and traced them till they reached a dry watercourse near the rock. There we left his meal, thinking that if he came for it, this might help us to find Elsa. During the night, we heard the lion roaring in the distance, and were therefore surprised next morning to find his pug marks close to the camp. He had not taken the meat we had put out close to the camp, but had gone to the kill we had left for him near the rock. This he had dragged for at least half a mile through most difficult terrain. As far as we could see, he had not touched it, so we thought that Elsa too might be close by, and that her gallant mate had dragged the 400-pound burden this long distance for her benefit. It was 4 days now since we'd seen Elsa, and 6 since she had eaten anything, unless she had shared the waterbuck with her mate. We believed that she had given birth to the cubs on the night of the 20th of December, and we did not think that it could be a coincidence that her lion, who had not been about for days, had reappeared on that night and remained close to the spot ever since, which was most unusual. On Christmas Eve, George went to get a goat, while I continued the fruitless search and called to Elsa without getting any answer. It was with a heavy heart that I prepared our little Christmas tree. In the past, I've always improvised one. Sometimes I took a small candelabra euphorbia, from whose symmetrical branches I hung tinsel chains and into whose fleshy fibre I stuck candles. Sometimes I used an aloe with its wide-spreading sprays of flowers. When I could find nothing else, I filled a dish with sand, stuck candles into it, and decorated it with whatever plants I could pick in our semi-desert surroundings. But tonight, I had a real little tree, complete with glittering tinsel branches, sparkling decorations, and candles. I placed it on a table outside the tents, which I'd covered with flowers and greenery. Then I collected the presents, which I'd brought for George, Makede, Nuru, Ibrahim, the Toto, and the cook, and the sealed envelopes containing money for the boys, on which I'd painted a Christmas tree branch. There were also packets of cigarettes and dates and tins of milk for them. I changed quickly into a frock, and by then it was dark enough to light the candles. I called the men, who came dressed up for the occasion, grinning but a little shy, for never before had they seen a Christmas tree of this kind. I must admit to having been myself deeply moved when I saw the little silver tree sparkling in the vast darkness of the surrounding bush, bringing the message of the birth of Christ. On Christmas Eve, I always feel like a small child. To break the tension, I told the men about the European custom of celebrating Christmas Eve with a tree. After I had given them their presents, we all gave 3 cheers for Elsa. Elsa! Elsa! The sound seemed to hang on the air, and I felt a lump rise in my throat. Was she alive? Quickly, I told the cook to bring in the plum pudding, which we had brought from Isiolo, and then to pour brandy over it and light it. But no bluish flame arose, for our Christmas pudding was a soggy mass, which had a distinct smell of Worcester sauce. Certainly the cook had never been in charge of such a ritual. He had paid no attention to my instructions, and had remained fixed in his belief that George so loved his Leon Perrins that it must be appropriate to souse even the plum pudding with it. We were not, however, the only ones to be disappointed in our Christmas dinner. We had hung a goat carcass out of the reach of predators, which we would lower if Elsa appeared. After we'd gone to bed, we heard her lion grunting and growling by the tree, and performing all sorts of acrobatics. He went on for a long time, and then retired exhausted. Early on Christmas morning, we followed the lion's spoor across the river and again screened the bush all round the spot to which he had dragged the waterbuck. After hours of tracking, we came back for breakfast. During the morning, George shot at an aggressive cobra, which we found close to the camp. We tried to cheer ourselves up by quoting cases of bitches who would not leave their litter for the first 5 or 6 days because they had to keep them warm, feed them, and massage their bellies to help their digestive functions to start working. Indeed, we had expected Elsa to have a rather similar reaction, but this did not account for the absence of any trace of her. Also, bitches do occasionally go and visit their masters, even during this first period, after their delivery. And as Elsa had shown more attachment to us than to her mate, up to the time at which her labour began, it seemed improbable and ominous that the fact of giving birth should have caused her to go completely wild. At midday, we returned to camp and began a very gloomy and silent Christmas meal. Suddenly, there was a swift movement, and before I could take in what was happening, Elsa was between us, sweeping everything off the table, knocking us to the ground, sitting on us and overwhelming us with joy and affection. Her figure was normal again. She looked superbly fit, but her teats were very small and apparently dry. Round each was a dark red circle, some 2 inches wide. Cautiously, I squeezed a teat. It produced no milk. We gave her some meat, which she immediately ate. Meanwhile, we discussed many questions. Why had she come to visit us during the hottest part of the day, a time when normally she would never move? Could it be that she had chosen it deliberately, because it was the safest time to leave the cubs, since few predators would be on the prowl in such heat? Or had she heard the shot which George had fired at the cobra, and had she taken it as a signal to her? Why were her teats small and dry? Had she just suckled the cubs? But this would not seem to explain why her milk glands, which had been so big during her pregnancy, had now shrunk to their normal size. Had the cubs died? And whatever had happened, why had she waited so long before coming to us for food? After she had had a good meal and drunk some water, she rubbed her head affectionately against us, walked about 30 yards down the river, lay down, and had a doze. We left her alone, so that she should feel at ease. When I looked for her at tea time, she had gone. We followed her spoor for a short way. It led towards the rock range, but we soon lost it, and returned none the wiser about her cubs. However, now that we were reassured about Elsa, our morale was restored. Next day, we were worried about her cubs, because we had been warned by zoo authorities that hand-reared lionesses often produce abnormal cubs, which do not live, and indeed one of Elsa's sisters had suffered such a misfortune. We felt we just must know about the cubs and rescue them if necessary. So the next morning, we searched for 5 hours, but we did not find so much as a dropping or a crushed leaf, let alone any spoor to show where Elsa's nursery was. We carried on equally unsuccessfully in the afternoon. While plodding through the bush, George nearly stepped on an exceptionally large puff adder and was lucky to be able to shoot it just before it could strike. Half an hour later, we heard Ibrahim popping off a gun, a signal that Elsa had arrived in camp. Obviously, she had responded to the shot with which George had dispatched the puff adder. When we got back, we were alarmed to observe that her teats were still small and dry. Ibrahim, however, assured us that when she had arrived, they and her milk glands had been enormous, hanging low and swinging from side to side. He also told us that her behaviour had been very unusual. When he fetched the gun from the kitchen, which was in the direction from which she had come, she dashed angrily at him. Possibly she thought he was going to her cubs. Later, when he went to the studio to collect her meat, she had prevented him from touching her kill. After this, she had settled on the Land Rover, and it was then that Ibrahim noticed that her teats and glands had shrunk to their normal size. She had, he said, tucked them up, and he told us that camels and cattle can withhold their milk by retracting their teats. We wondered whether such a retraction explained the peculiar state of Elsa's teats. Was it not possible that a lioness might be capable of a similar reaction, and could contract her teats when hunting? While we were asking ourselves these questions, Elsa, having eaten enormously, had settled down and showed no intention of returning to her cubs. This alarmed me, because it was getting dark and the worst moment to leave them alone. We tried to induce her to return to them by walking along the path down which she had come. She followed us reluctantly, listening alertly in the direction of the rock, but soon returned to camp. We wondered whether she might be afraid that we would follow her and find her cubs. Meanwhile, she went back to her meal, and it was only after she had methodically cleaned up every scrap of it that, much to our relief, she disappeared into the dark. Very likely, she had waited till there was no light to make sure we could not follow her. We were now convinced that she was looking after her cubs, but we could not be happy until we had seen for ourselves that they were normal. Very early we set out and followed Elsa's spoor, which led towards the big rock. After we'd called loudly for half an hour, she suddenly appeared out of a cluster of bush only 20 yards away. She seemed rather shocked at seeing us, stared and kept silent and very still, as though hoping we would not come nearer. Perhaps we were so close to her nursery that she thought it better to appear and so prevent us from finding it. After a few moments, she walked up to us and was very affectionate to George, myself, Makede, and the Toto, but never uttered a sound. To my relief, I saw that her teats were twice their normal length, and that the hair around them was still wet from suckling. Soon she went slowly back towards the bush and stood for about 5 minutes, with her back turned towards us, listening intently for any sound from the thicket. Then she sat down, still with her back turned to us. No words could have conveyed her wishes more clearly. We sneaked away as quietly as we could, making a detour in order to climb to the top of the big rock. From it we looked down and saw her sitting just as we had left her. Obviously she had got our scent, knew just what we were doing, and did not intend to let us discover her lie-up. This made me realize how unaware we had been, in spite of our intimacy with Elsa, of the reactions of wild animals. It amused me to remember how we had prepared ourselves against the possibility of the cubs being born in our tent, and how we had flattered ourselves that Elsa regarded it as the place in which she felt safest. We decided that we must respect Elsa's wishes, and not try to see the cubs until she brought them to us, which we felt sure she would do one day. I determined to stay on in camp, and decided to take her meals to her, so as to reduce the time during which she had to desert the cubs. One afternoon, when I was passing the big rock, I saw a very strange animal standing on it. In the dim light, it looked like a cross between a hyena and a small lion. When it saw me, it sneaked off with the gait of a cat. It had obviously spotted the cubs, and I was much alarmed. After this, I made up my mind that in spite of her disapproval, I'd better find out how many cubs there were and whether they were all right. I might then be able to help in an emergency. On the 11th of January, I did an unpardonable thing. I left a game scout with the rifle on the road below, and accompanied by the Toto, whom Elsa knew well, I climbed the rock face, calling repeatedly to warn her of our approach. She did not answer. I told the Toto to take off his sandals so as not to make any noise. When he had reached the top, we stood on the edge of the cliff and raked the bush below with our field glasses. Immediately under us was the place from which Elsa had emerged that first time, when we'd surprised her and she'd stood on guard. Now there was no sign of her, but the place looked like a well-used nursery and was ideal for the purpose. Although I was concentrating very hard on my examination of the bush below us, I suddenly had a strange feeling, dropped my field glasses, turned and saw Elsa creeping up behind the Toto. I'd just time to shout a warning to him before she knocked him down. She'd crept up the rock behind us quite silently, and the Toto only missed toppling over the cliff by a hair's breadth, and that mainly because his feet were bare, which gave him the chance of getting a grip on the rock. Next, Elsa walked over to me and knocked me over in a friendly way, but it was very obvious that she was expressing annoyance at finding us so close to her cubs. After this demonstration, she walked slowly along the crest of the rock, from time to time looking back over her shoulder to make sure that we were following her. Silently, she led us to the far end of the ridge. There we climbed down into the bush. As soon as we were on level ground, she rushed ahead, repeatedly turning her head back to confirm that we were coming. In this way, she took us back to the road, but she made a wide detour, presumably to avoid passing near the cubs. I interpreted her complete silence as a wish not to alarm them or to prevent them from emerging and following us. When we walk together, I usually pat Elsa occasionally, and she likes it. But today she would not allow me to touch her and made it clear that I was in disgrace. Even when she was eating her dinner on the roof of the car back in camp, whenever I came near her, she turned away from me. She did not go to the cubs until it was dark. On the 2nd of February, while I was writing in the studio, the Toto came running to tell me that Elsa was calling in a very strange voice from the other side of the river. I went upstream, following the sound, till I broke through the undergrowth at a place close to camp, where in the dry season there is a fairly wide sandbank on our side, and on the other a sand lugger, a dry watercourse which drops abruptly into the river. Suddenly I stopped, unable to believe my eyes. There was Elsa, standing on the sandbank within a few yards of me, one cub close to her, a second cub emerging from the water shaking itself dry, and the third one still on the far bank, pacing to and fro and calling piteously. Elsa looked fixedly at me, her expression a mixture of pride and embarrassment. I remained absolutely still while she gave a gentle moan to her young that sounded like, Then she walked up to the landing cub, licked it affectionately, and turned back to the river to go to the youngster who was stranded on the far bank. The two cubs who had come across with her followed her immediately, swimming bravely through the deep water, and soon the family were reunited. Near to where they landed, a fig tree grows out of some rocks, whose grey roots grip the stone like a net. Elsa rested in its shade, her golden coat showing up vividly against the dark green foliage and the silver-grey boulders. At first the cubs hid, but soon their curiosity got the better of their shyness. They began by peeping cautiously at me through the undergrowth, and then came out into the open and stared inquisitively. Elsa mmmed, which reassured them, and when they were quite at their ease they began to climb onto their mother's back and tried to catch her switching tail, rolling affectionately over her, exploring the rocks and squeezing their fat little tummies under the roots of the fig tree. They forgot all about me. After a while, Elsa rose and went to the water's edge, intending to enter the river again. Unfortunately, at this moment, the Toto, whom I'd sent back to fetch Elsa's food, arrived with it. Immediately she flattened her ears and remained immobile until the boy had dropped the meat and gone away. Then she waited till all her family were at her feet and started to swim across. This time all three cubs came with her. As soon as they landed, she licked each one in turn, and then instead of charging up to me as she usually does when coming out of the river, she walked up slowly, rubbed herself gently against me, rolled in the sand, licked my face, and finally hugged me. I was very much moved by her obvious wish to show her cubs that we were friends. Reassured, the cubs crept cautiously closer till they were within 3 feet of me. I found it difficult to restrain an impulse to lean forward and touch them, but I remembered the warning a zoologist had given me, never touch cubs unless they take the initiative, and this 3-foot limit seemed to be an invisible boundary which they felt that they must not cross. Next, Elsa and the cubs went to the carcass, which she started eating while the youngsters licked the skin and tore at it, somersaulted over it, and became very excited. It was probably their first encounter with a kill. The evidence suggested that they were 6 weeks and 2 days old. They were in excellent condition, and though they still had a bluish film over their eyes, they could certainly see perfectly. Their coats had fewer spots than Elsa's or her sister's, and were also much less thick than theirs had been at the same age, but far finer.